Billy Budd, the handsome sailor. Billy, but tell you about that Billy Budd. He's
yeah.
Is that the question? Or you should actually just stop it right there. What can jizz? Question mark. What can jizz? What? Neither is it a, is it the prostate? Yeah, the prostate. That's it. Yeah, I'd say actually the balls and the penis are incidental. The penis is a delivery mechanism. Yeah. Or no, does a barrel shoot or a bullet factory shoot? Like what shoots? The barrel? Yeah. In the prostate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can... and you can jizz... See, that's the thing, is you can jizz after the balls have been taken out of the equation. So, like... So it ain't the balls. Mm-hmm. I'll... Final answer... It's, yeah. So 3 days ago, this question occurred to you. Oh my God. Can a society jizz? I mean, I'm sure there's a little bit going on with Bud and the I mean, there's a lot of fancy in Bud going around, so maybe it's platonic though. Maybe it's just like cuddling in the, stinky forecastle or wherever. All right. All right. Save your dad jokes until after I get through this intro. All right. Can ideas jizz? All right. Hello, all, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. This is the podcast you turn to after bouncing off of Slate's Culture Gab Fest for the fourth time, are too tired for more jokes about Taco Bell from the McElroy brothers, and start to feel panicky when you realize that Dan Carlin has not released an episode of Hardcore History in nearly an entire calendar year. Not to suggest that we give a shit about contemporary culture, history, or laughs. We discuss books. And I shouldn't throw stones. We're up our own asses, too. Thanks for listening. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. Today we're discussing a collection of shorter Herman Melville works, Billy Budd the Sailor, which is a novella, and the collection of short stories called Piazza Tales. Billy Budd, published posthumously, tells the story of an uneducated black sailor who's conscripted from duty aboard a civilian vessel into a military ship. Ridiculously handsome and charismatic, he's loved by all but the ship's master-at-arms, John Claggart. Claggart falsely accuses Bud of planning mutiny, and Bud struggles to defend himself due to a stutter. Frustrated, he attacks Claggart and accidentally kills him. The heart of the novella, for me, are the deliberations between Captain Veer and his officers, all of whom accept plainly that Bud was innocent of Claggart's charges, and neither was Bud seeking to kill his accuser. Bud is, however, guilty for raising his hand against an officer, and due to recent issues in the Royal Navy with dissension and mutiny, the laws are very clear. Bud is guilty. And Veer determines this, though he recognizes Bud's fundamental innocence. Out of duty to the laws of man, he sentences Bud to death. The Piazza Tales is a collection of short stories published a few years after Moby Dick. It has six stories: The Piazza, Bartleby the Scrivener, Benito Cereno, The Lightning Rod Man, The Encantadas or Enchanted Isles, and The Bell Tower. I found two of these stories to be excellent, Benito Cereno and Bartleby, three to be really interesting and fun to read, The Piazza, The Lightning Rod Man, and Encantadas, and one to be a real shit-ass stinker, The Bell Tower. Whatever. Melville can take it. He wrote the greatest American novel. We can go into the stories as we need to, but I fear that summarizing all of them here is kind of a mess. I'll summarize the two we're most likely to talk about, though, Bartleby and Benito Cereno, which, for good reason, persist to this day outside of this collection as true classics. Bartleby is the story of the title character as observed by his employer, who hires Bartleby to help handle all the copy editing taken in by his office. Bartleby starts on well, but then begins to decline to do any work, saying only, "I would prefer not to." The narrator goes through some lengths to check Bartleby's fall, keeping him on at first despite Bartleby not working, but Bartleby does eventually lose his job, apparently loses his place of residence, is arrested, and dies in detention. Benito Cereno is the story of slaves seizing control of a ship, slave ship, and officers that are transporting them, as told through the perspective of Delano, the captain of another ship that notices the distress of the slave ship and comes to its aid. He's a bumbling racist moron, though, inclined to believe that black people are naturally inclined to servitude And so the former slaves are able to conceal the fact that they have seized the ship while Delano is aboard. The facade breaks finally when the slave ship captain, held all this time against his will, dives for Delano's tender when the latter is preparing to leave. Delano then seizes the ship with his men, the African prisoners are re-enslaved, and the leader of the uprising, Babo, is put to death. So, like I said, we can talk about some of the other Piazza tales. I was really struggling to describe the Encantadas, and I decided to just shelve it and describe those two. But I have some questions here, and I figure we can start by talking about Billy Budd. I wanted to talk about more broadly Melville. We've all read Moby Dick, we've read Billy Budd and the Piazza Tales at this point. So here's my first question. Billy Budd and the Piazza Tales are idea stories, and I guess Moby Dick is an ideas novel, but it's so funny and weird and shaggy and prismatic that it belays the clarity that often comes with idea stories. Having read these and other works by Melville, does anyone recognize any common themes or concerns across his body of work? And if you've read other books by him, Typee, I think Patrick and I have both read Typee, but it's been so long, I barely remember it. But do you guys pick up on any themes like that sort of like span these works that we've read for this episode, maybe include Moby Dick, or are we kind of too small of a sample size? Patrick. I'm thinking of, I don't know if this is a good example of peaceful, but I pulled up this one paragraph from Benito Cereno, which I really fucking love. I love the whole piece, but this one paragraph got me. And this is, Delano is aboard the slave ship, and he is in conference with Don Benito, the captain of the slave ship, who is attended by Babo, who is sort of playing as Don Benito's servant, or, you know, personal like slave servant, but is actually like threatening Benito with death if Benito gives the game away. And their meeting in conference is the context for this scene. That's Babo. The Negro placed a rug under Don Benito's feet and a cushion behind his back, and then stood behind not his master's chair, but Captain Delano's. At first, this a little surprised the latter, but it was soon evident that, in taking his position, the black was still true to his master, since by facing him, he could the more readily anticipate his slightest want. Which is, it's a joke, because like Delano, so basically, Babbo is standing behind Delano, and Delano thinks that that's more, at first, that that's more appropriate, a position, you know, the servant should be standing behind his own master, but he's not looking at Babbo. He just sort of feels him back there. And Benito, you know, Babbo is able to sort of make faces and like, you know, gesture with like furiously with a knife and, you know, and also like maybe stab Delano in the back. And I just sort of, it's not necessarily like cosmopolitanism in like, in terms of like the plurality of like, culture and, but also the plurality of intelligence and agency. And, you know, going back to what Hans said, you know, the kind of the different layers of authority here, because like Delano is a moron and like a total boob. And Benito is ostensibly in charge, but the person who's in charge here is Babbo. And Babbo is so quiet throughout this whole piece because he's just kind of lurking in the margins, and it's very interesting. It seems when I was reading about it that the story has sort of evolved with time to be read as, you know, not very conscious of the enslaved Africans, you know, sort of repressed agency, or maybe hyper conscious of it in its, you know, in how he portrays its repression or through the eyes of an oppressor. But I felt like it was a very sensitive story, but I don't know how you guys felt. Sure. Do it. I think that that makes sense. I mean, like, I think that it's interesting to read Bartleby as almost like a story of, it's like a story about class and disenfranchisement or like depression or something like that, or falling out of the machine of society before there's a framework to talk about it, almost like just sort of like if we were to sort of suck away Marxism and say like, okay, like there's no need to apply this framework, then, you know, the sort of despair of Bartleby's employer, who's our protagonist in Bartleby the Scrivener, is kind of this like sort of like empty puzzlement. Like ultimately, like Bartleby's like he's a cipher. Like you don't really, like, I don't think there's any really clear reason. The protagonist discovers something about, oh yeah, Bartleby worked in a dead letter office, and the protagonist makes some sort of like gesture at the end, like, oh, maybe he was deeply affected by this, you know, experience, you know, with in this office. And that seems silly. Like it seems very like this to me, it just felt read like a kind of almost like you said, like someone applying a framework without really understanding, you know, like why was Bartleby so sad? Why was he withdrawing from, you know, the capitalistic machine and society and like everyday life? And it's like, oh, well, he had this experience. And it feels like the real, like, kind of like gravity at the center of Bartleby is that, like, there doesn't have to be a reason, or like there doesn't have to be an explanation, and that this is just a puzzling, natural, like, turn of events where somebody just shuts off. And oh, yeah. Yeah, I know what you're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. A really interesting point though, Hans, that like when you're approaching something that's been in like so that's taken such deep root in like our kind of social consciousness, I don't know about like you know the post-literate society that we're entering now, but like but basically like we all have had just sort of like some kind of like glancing experience with the story of Bartleby, like, you know, either I think that there was an adaptation with the guy who plays the dad in Back to the Future. I never saw it, but there's, you know, it's in a lot of, you know, collections. It's you know, just cited a lot in a lot of different situations, that you have this sort of like shared understanding of what it's about. And then there's a detail in the book detail in the work itself that you have to do something with. And, you know, probably we're inclined to ignore it or ascribe it to something else. And maybe that's the magic of first person, right? Like you can play apologia with something that old and say like, well, this is actually just a detail about that first person narrator. That's what it is. And I say that even though I think I agree with Patrick, but I can't raise Melville from the dead and say like, is this what you intended? Sorry, Hans. Do you guys think that if Moby Dick didn't exist, we would be talking about any of these stories or particular ones? Like, is Benito Cereno, Bartleby, Billy Budd, you know, maybe you can make an argument for the others. Are they substantive enough on their own to be like part of the canon without Melville's, you know, like other masterpiece putting them there? Yeah, and he was never like a huge success from what I read. Like, I don't think that, like, they were, he had some success, but I don't know if any of these were like considered master, like something that belonged in, like, that needed to be regarded, you know, for, you know, in the future. Bartleby strikes me as like, I'm thinking of Billy Budd, Benito Cereno. There's a lot of, and I think that this is like, I love Moby Dick and I love it for its digressive, like essayistic quality. Like, it's like constantly, veering into nonfiction spaces, and you can feel that, you know, throughout the Piazza Tales and in Billy Budd. But I'm trying to think, I don't think I remember that in Bartleby. Bartleby feels more focused. Oh yeah, the whiteness of the whale is incredible. The, you know, the cetology. But like, I'll say, like, I think I'll go out on a limb and say Billy Budd. I loved Benito Cereno. Billy Budd, I liked. I really did. For me, I think I said this in my intro that the Captain Veer and his officers discussing how they needed to respond, like, and how that knit together the kind of, like, you know, there's several chapters at the beginning of Billy Budd that cover, like, the issues with mutiny in the Royal Navy and, you know, how the state has responded. And then Captain Veer being in this position of identifying with, like, what he describes as God's law, you know, forgiveness, and the obvious, you know, innocence of Billy Budd on some kind of, like, you know, foundational level. But then his own responsibilities to man's law and choosing to condemn Billy Budd. And that to me was, like, it took a while to get there, and we got there, and it was worth it. But actually, I kind of felt like those stories are sort of hurt for being smaller. Like, I, you know, like, Moby Dick, and I guess there could probably be only one like this, but, like, it's just so big. It just sort of just keeps going and gets bigger and strange. It just is, like, and, like, you know, that's that to me, like, I think I'm with you, Hans, like, Bartleby, you know, I think it's more attuned to the structure of a short story, maybe, and, like, and it's just a really damn good one. And it feels also, like, in that, even though it's focused down to kind of a point, it's bigger than it is, you know, like, it takes up much more space than it does on the page. And I do kind of, I love Benito Cereno, but I think that Bartleby stands the test of time. What did you guys? Go ahead, Patrick. No. You're. Go ahead. Do you think that he's underrated, overly rated, or properly rated? Underrated, overrated, not overly rated. Underrated, overrated, or properly rated? Yeah, they did. They exiled you, didn't they? They disowned you eventually for all those mean things you were saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. See, you acted all naive about, like, those mean things that you're saying about the establishment, and you can't help it, like, snipe backwards. I have nothing to say about Jennifer. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well. If you are listening to this, Jennifer, please, yeah, you can, well, no, she can come to the one on Moby Dick. If you are listening to this, we're going to redo Moby Dick at some point, because I think it's not up anymore. And you can come to that one, so reach out. Oh, you put it back up? Well, we should redo it anyway, because it's a goddamn fucking masterpiece. It's very interesting, because, like, you know, I guess, like, you comparing, like, we have great writers who, you know, like James Joyce, who has, you know, I don't know if, like, I love all of his work as much as, like, the literary establishment seems to love all of his work, but it's like, you got the Dubliners, you got Ulysses, you got, you know, Portrait of the Writer's Young Man, and you got, like, all these, like, incredible, like, works. And then, like, Melville, you know, Piazza Tales is not Dubliners. I really hated The Bell Tower. Like, I absolutely despised it. I don't know if it was also, if it was in part because I love Moby Dick. I love Billy Budd, Benito Cereno. Bartleby is not very much like this, I guess, but it has moments like Melville's really funny. Like, he's like such a funny writer. Like, and it's like, he's fucking hilarious. And The Bell Tower is so, you know, I don't know. Like, it, can someone be properly rated as a master of the form when they poop out a dud like The Bell Tower? I'll just leave that, but they can. We're not talking renowned poet. We're talking like one of the most highly regarded writers of all time. Like, this is like, you know, Shakespeare's duds are, you know, what is it? Gentleman of Verona, you know, like, it's like, you know, still good. I'm just saying that, like, this is, I think we've discovered this is what the podcast should be. No, probably not. Yeah. Yeah. two faces of the Janus. I'm being kind of an asshole. I mean, I think that you're right. I think that that's why, like, why I love Moby Dick for how, like, shaggy and just incredibly ambitious and self-assured it is in that shagginess, which doesn't, it seems like it just defies gravity and then it starts by defying gravity and then starts to defy all the laws of physics. And it's like just insane. And then, you know, the fact that he also has Bartleby in him is incredible. I think that, you can still be like one of the greatest of all time. After writing those and have a bell tower in you. And I think that that's fine. I think that that's it. That's all I had. Any other things that I didn't touch upon or you guys wanted to say? Is it, whose turn is it? I never know. I need to know this shit. I believe it's yours then. Oh. Oh, yeah. Is one of those secretly written by an AI and you're going to like gotcha us? Yeah, you're going to gotcha us in the middle of the episode. I believe that. I love it. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in. We've discussed Melville's Billy Budd and his collection, The Piazza Tales, and highly recommend it. I think, you know, all things being equal, Melville is worth your time. And join us next time where we will be discussing AI and why Jude Law got scorned for the Oscars that year. All right. All right. Nice talking to you guys.